from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The first retrospective featuring the work of photographer Carrie Mae Weems is now on display at the Cantor Art Center on the Stanford University campus, a retrospective that some in the art world think is long overdue for this influential African-American artist. Her work examines race, gender, relationships, and history, a body of work that netted Weems one of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grants just a few weeks ago. We'll talk with Carrie Mae Weems about her work, winning the MacArthur, and the new exhibit after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The first major retrospective of the artist and photographer Carrie Mae Weems is now on display at Stanford's Cantor Art Center. It's work that is somehow cerebral, striking, and sensual all at the same time. There's the Kitchen Table series, which features Weems and a revolving series of characters as they sift out the drama of personal and professional life. There's the indistinct images of Josephine Baker and other African-American artists titled Fade to Black, calling attention to the way legacies lose their shape and sharpness over time. And there's a stunning series called From Here I Saw What Happened and I Cried, which vividly reframe anthropological photos to convey how African-Americans have been portrayed over time. Carrie Mae Weems was just named a MacArthur Genius Grant winner, and she's in the Bay Area, where she once studied art, this week for the opening of Carrie Mae Weems, Three Decades of Photography and Video at the Cantor Art Center on the Stanford campus. And we welcome Carrie Mae Weems to our program this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
I wanted to ask you first about the way in which you use the camera to create truth that is more than strictly documentary imagery. So many of us, me included, walk into photo exhibits and you see captured images of life as it is. You do that, but you add to it. And it's interesting to me because it's a way of creating truth that goes beyond factuality, if that makes sense. Can you describe your approach and how that what it is that you are seeking to achieve?
Well, it's a difficult question. It's so hard to describe the visual with words, which is one of the reasons that we make photographs or films or, you know, or we're involved in dance. I mean, you know, we do those things because words don't always handle the depths of where we're trying to go as visual artists, performing artists, and so forth. But I think, you know, when I started my career, really, I started as a documentary photographer, and I love documentary photographs and the way that they worked. At a certain period, I became a little concerned about that, and I thought that it might be important for me to step back, and that and discovered somehow, really, that ultimately what you're really trying to do simply as an artist, as a photographer, filmmaker, dancer, writer, is to get at some notion of the truth, and that truth could be constructed, and that indeed photographs are highly constructed documents to begin with, even when we call them documentary. And so I started using these conceptual approaches to the making of photographs and setting up photographs, like, for instance, with the Kitchen Table series, where there's a woman who is always in the same place with a low-hanging light of interrogation over her head, and various characters enter and exit the scene. And yet, even though it was manufactured and produced in my own living room, it has the feel of a sense of documentary, and it points to documentary photography, but it's really highly constructed images. And yet somehow it's a work that seems to get very much to the truth of the lives of men and women as they negotiate the patterns of life and relationship, traditional and or otherwise.
And we should note for our listeners that if they want to see that photograph, one of the photographs from the Kitchen Table series, as well as other examples from the retrospective now on at Stanford's Kenner Arts Center, they're on our website. So if you want to go to it and get a sense of the work of Carrie Mae Weems, just go to our website, kqed.org forum, and you can see an example of that work. We're joined along with Carrie Mae Weems by Elizabeth Mitchell, who is the curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Kenner Arts Center. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Why was it so important to Stanford and to really the art world in general that this retrospective take place now?
Well, I think the recognition that comes with a retrospective of this size and scale, it was way overdue for Carrie. And then even having said that, you know, I've been spending a lot of time with this work in the gallery, and it would be a much different experience if it would have happened 10 years earlier. Some of her recent work is so dynamic and pithy and layered that I can't imagine the retrospective without some of this more recent work.
Holland Cotter, Carrie Mae Weems, the New York Times critic, is quoted in the foreword to the exhibit catalog that's written by Henry Louis Gates as saying that nobody has produced more probing, moving, and varied work than you have, and that a retrospective was long overdue. Did you feel ignored? Did you feel like this was something that should have happened much sooner?
You know, no. I mean, you know, it's no, of course not. You know, I'm, of course, I have my ego, but I'm also very humble. And I was very touched by that. I was very moved by that. But I didn't feel, nor have I felt for a very, very long time, that my work has been ignored. I've had traveling exhibitions. The first exhibition actually was produced by the National Museum of Women in the Arts, and that exhibition toured the United States as well. I've had major exhibitions in Europe. There was a beautiful retrospective that was organized in 2010. We produced a very beautiful book for that called Social Studies. And now this incredible, incredible honor of yet another major touring exhibition of the work. So I've, you know, very much felt like my work has been engaged with in a very serious way for a very long time. And I suppose one of the things that I'm usually more concerned with is not really what's going on with me personally at any given moment, but rather what's being shown significantly in institutions around the country. How are other artists, women artists, minority artists, being represented in the significant museums of our country? Those ideas are really more, to my mind, the thing that I care about in some instances more than I care about my own artistic production or showing it.
And I also know you're concerned about who comes to museums and trying to alter the demographics of that. How are you approaching that about getting, you know, a more diverse group of museum attendees so that they can take in these images that you've produced about that very diversity?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this is really interesting. I think perhaps Elizabeth can speak more to the point of this. But of course, often I'm involved with the public programming for along with the institute that is that's bringing the work, whether it's here at the Cantor or at the Cleveland Museum of Art or at the Frist Center, which is actually where the exhibition began a year and a half ago. So I'm often involved with that. But I think that the thing that's sort of more, perhaps, David, more important to get to and to realize is that that the role of museums, the role of the museum is changing. The role of the museum has to change in relationship to the constituency in which it serves, and that the demographics of the country is also changing.
Yeah.
And that all of these things, I think, are in the mix, forcing institutions, museums, universities to shift focus. And as they have to shift focus in relationship to its demographic, I think that that also means that it has to be much more aware of what is on its walls, who's being represented in those spaces. And the more you are represented, a people or a group is represented in any institution, the more those people, that group, is likely to participate with that institution. And so I'm highly aware of that fact. I think that the museums are. I think that the Cantor Center, with its great educational program, is also aware of it. And I think I'll step back for a moment and Elizabeth talk as a curator about their position.
Well, it's an interesting point, and it seems counterintuitive in some ways, but because one thinks of Stanford as being this elite institution, which it is. But I was reminded, and I actually looked up this morning, that the majority of undergraduates at Stanford are people of color.
Absolutely.
And that in many ways, Stanford is quite representative of the Bay Area.
Absolutely.
And that this idea of having a place like Stanford represent this art is both fitting, but part of what has to also continue if a different group of people are going to take advantage of what's offered.
Oh, definitely. And not only do we have this diverse student body that's very engaged with the museum, but physically we're also located not just near the city and the East Bay, but also East Palo Alto and down into Silicon Valley. So we're geographically, we're in a position to really draw fairly easily a wide audience in to see the show. And we're definitely working to do that.
I want to talk more about the exhibit, of course, over the course of our time. But Carrie Mae Weems, would you also talk some about the work that you're doing in your hometown of Syracuse, New York, and the way in which you are also using art to do what you call activating the community and engaging young people in the art world?
Well, you know, a few years ago, I started in response to the escalating violence in our neighborhood. I started in Syracuse, New York. I started a project called Project Activate, which was a billboard project and a public arts campaign, really, circulating leaflets and broadsides, matchbook covers and church fans and leaflets that went out through the Sunday newspaper and again the billboard project. And it was a wonderful, wonderful project to be to do, to think about, to consider, exciting, probing. The community really got behind the project, and not the community in sort of like the narrowest sense, but the community of Syracuse really got behind the project. They were very excited about it. And then I realized at a certain point that I had responded to a situation that was critical, that was important, but it was not necessarily quote solution oriented. And so in thinking about that, thinking about how to move these kids who are involved in gangs from the street to the studio, I came with this idea of about developing an institute, which I call the Institute of Sound and Style. And the Institute of Sound and Style is to introduce kids to any number of possibilities within the world of artistic and cultural production. So, for instance, I thought, well, a kid doesn't have to be a rapper. They could actually be a recording engineer. They could be a graphic designer. They could be the videographer. They could be the photographer. They could be the graphic designer. They could be the choreographer. I mean, there were all of these sort of other possibilities. And so I started a small institute. It's a summer program. that runs for 8 weeks or so over the course of the summer. We're hoping, of course, to become an after-school program in the next year or so. We pay our kids because they're poor kids. They have to have money or they get in trouble. They're out on the street. And we provide this very wonderful, focused way of introducing kids, high school students for the most part, to the possibilities of cultural production. And it has been really an amazing thing, and the kids love it. I love working with them. We've been doing it now for the last couple of years, and this year will be our third year, and it's been quite successful so far.
And how does that then tie into the work that you have done for many decades and continue to do in terms of how people of color are represented? Because it seems like that this effort would be something that would also not only change how people are represented by having people move into those professions, but that they would also then become producers of those images too.
That's right. That's right. I think, you know, being in command of your own artistic production, your own self-creation, is absolutely essential, that it really does start to shift and change the dynamics of what is represented and how it's represented, and therefore what we come to know about a group of people. I mean, it's been very important to me, and it has been really the core of the work for a very long time. How are African Americans, how are women represented through the visual image, whether that be in still photography or in film or in literature for that matter? How are we represented? And so being in charge of your own cultural production, knowing that it's a construction and that construction can swing one way or another, is absolutely key. And so I'm very excited to be working with my kids. I think my kids are also really excited to be working with me. I give them as much as I would give any graduate student at any university. I work very, very closely with them in terms of how they produce and what they produce, trying to just instill that sense that there are great possibilities for them, and that how they are and how they present themselves is absolutely key to what people will come away with and know about them.
Have you spotted a next Carrie Mae Weems among that group?
There are a couple of very interesting young people who I keep very, very close to me, that I want to have that I want to serve as a mentor and a guide in their lives and in their work. So there are a few that I keep close to me. One is a great young photographer, and the other is a wonderful singer.
Would you describe, for those who have not seen it, the series that I referenced in the introduction to this program, From Here I Saw What Happened and I Cried, because it's an example of taking images of the way people were once portrayed and then in a very striking way reframing them to just jump right out at you.
It's really sort of an amazing work. You know, I've been so lucky because I've been that piece really in the beginning was it came about as a commission for the J. Paul Getty Museum. They were working with another very interesting collector of African American daguerreotypes and asked me to do a response exhibition in relationship to those daguerreotypes. There are actually very few daguerreotypes of African American subjects, very few, and very few surviving ones. And so I made this response work, which was really kind of wonderful. So what I did was, for the most part, the material is it's all appropriated photographs. I made very few of the images myself. They are all, for the most part, from history, and from various kinds of histories. So I took the photographs, I remade them, I reprinted them, I colored them a very intense red, I also overlaid a circular mat around the image, and then inscribed each image with a text that reads, you became a photographic subject and an anthropological debate. You became a Negroid type. You became a hope and a change. You became a field, yard, house, and kitchen. So, thinking through, it was a project that really looked at not only the relationship of African Americans to American photography, but it's also a work that looks at the history of photography and the use of the black subject in photography. And at the same time, it looks at the history of African Americans in the United States. And so it's this very interesting work that moves across a number of different platforms. For me, the important thing was that, yes, I needed to look at photographic history and then a look at African Americans within that history specifically, and then the use of language in relationship to both those histories. And so it's a very complicated work, but one that I'm still very intrigued by it, and that it teaches me a great deal about the art of looking.
And it also seems to be something that is an example of what you do to create something where the whole is greater than the sum of all the parts. That you take an image from historic times and you add and embellish and reframe and add to that, and then it is something that you've brought something more to it than what was there, and we bring then something more to our experience of taking it in.
Well, you know, there's something I think kind of amazing about this, and the practice of being an artist and really attempting to dig deep in relationship to what has been made. And this important part, I think, as you said, the importance of reframing, I think, is absolutely key, and that there is a way in which we can use image and word to really dig into the complexity of our experience, and that it's only a small shift sometimes that's necessary. It doesn't have to be huge or radical. It's a small shift to the right or to the left, and understanding what the possibilities are. I mean, for me, the most important thing is that one has a critical dialogue with work, you know, to the extent that they have a critical dialogue with their lives, and that we are looking at our lives in search of truth, in search of compassion, in search of change. And for me, the work of art has the ability to assist us in getting to those new platforms and those new places in our lives.
And
let me know, whether we're talking about music or dance, my life has been changed by all of those things. And so I know that art has the power to shift you and to push you in other dimensions and other spaces that you would not necessarily go.
And let me hold you there, if I might, because we have to take a very short break. We'll continue and talk more with Carrie Mae Weems in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Carrie Mae Weems. An exhibition of her work, a retrospective of her work, is now at the Ketter Center for Visual Arts on the Stanford University campus. Carrie Mae Weems joins us, along with Elizabeth Mitchell, who is the curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Ketter Center. I have to ask you about the call that you got, Carrie Mae Weems, a few weeks back, that call that is probably the best call anyone could ever get from the MacArthur Foundation.
Oh, my God. It was just so amazing, David. I was, you know, I never in my life because I'm not particularly bright. I'm not, you know, I've never thought of myself as being particularly smart. I mean, so I never thought that the MacArthur would be coming my way. And so, you know, it was an afternoon. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. I was working as I always am. You know, I get up very, very early. I go to bed very, very late. And I work, you know, like very long days. You know, so I'm in the studio. I'm working. And I'm having a fit with my studio assistants, you know, because I think that I'm doing their work and my work. And, you know, the phone rings. And without thinking, I pick it up and I'm saying to my studio assistant, you know, I'm really sick of this, you know, when I pick up the phone and I say hello and I hear this voice saying, well, it's the MacArthur calling. I thought, the MacArthur? Oh, they probably want me to write a letter of recommendation for somebody else, I think. And I said, oh, no, we're calling about you. And I was standing up and I sank into my chair. I just was knocked off my feet. I could not believe that they were calling to award me this incredible prize. And I put my head down on my desk for 5 minutes and I cried. I just was absolutely overwhelmed. And I still am. I still don't quite believe it yet. I keep pinching myself, it's such an honor. It's such an honor to be in such illustrious company. And I've had other friends who've won, and I'm just quite overwhelmed by it. And it's really quite a surprise. There's nothing that can prepare you for a phone call like that.
And then did you turn to your staff and say, I take it all back, and you're all going to get big raises?
Exactly. They're all due very healthy Christmas bonuses, that's for sure.
You must have thought about what you're going to do with that. What is it, $650,000 or something?
It's a lot of money. You know, I thought, well, the first thing I thought I should do, I should buy a dress that's not on sale.
And?
So we'll see how far I get with that. But of course, one of the things that it allows me to do, the wonderful thing that it allows me to do is to really take care of my institute this year very easily and very directly so that I can sustain that program over the next few years with very little input from others. Though, frankly, I really like asking people in a way for to assist with it, because I think that it keeps it in the public in a way that's actually important. But it does allow me to do that. I must say, though, that while the MacArthur is, you know, it's major and it's wonderful, it's one of the highest honors you can receive in this country as an artist, and the money is fantastic, It's not really the money so much, which may sound a little strange to people out there struggling for a dollar, but it's not the money so much. But for me, it's the emotional support that comes with the award, because you know that hundreds of people literally had to agree that you deserve this award. And so, you know, many, many people were involved in it. Many people made it happen. Many voices made it happen. A great deal of support. And so I feel as though I have this incredible support at my back.
Carrie Mae
holding
Weems.
Me up. And so the emotional support of it is really sort of more interesting, and that I respond to that more. The outpouring of letters, emails, the loads of flowers, the bottles of champagne. I mean, it's been really quite extraordinary.
And someday,
like 400 emails to return.
And someday soon, a new dress, right?
And someday soon, a new dress.
Carrie Mae Weems joining us. Her exhibit is now at the Cantor Arts Center at Stanford University. We'd welcome your calls if you have a question. If you're an aspiring artist, a photographer, a young person who is trying to get started in the world of art or sound or style, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Elizabeth Mitchell, it occurs to me as Carrie Mae Weems is talking about her work and about now using this MacArthur to support her institute in Syracuse, that Stanford has also forged a connection with East Palo Alto in particular, and a relationship between students on campus and students there. And I'm interested in the way in which the art world at Stanford, and the Cantor in particular, is going to try to increase those sorts of connections so that the art center on campus is not just a campus art center, but it is one that is connected to the broader world of the Bay Area.
Well, something that many people don't realize is that the Cantor Art Center is one of the most highly attended university art museums in the country. It's not just for Stanford. And so through our programming, through the selection of exhibitions that we put on, we really are trying to create an environment that inspires students, inspires the community, and speaks to everyone. And Carrie's exhibition is a fantastic example of that. Many of her works may feature African-American subjects, but she's talking about the condition of being human, our struggles and our confrontations and the hopeful path in front of us. And a lot of people can relate to that. So we do design programming. We have a number of we have a new family program where we bring small children and families into the galleries to look at art and think about what's going on. And, you know, I'm so thrilled, I have to say kind of selfishly, with the timing of the award of the MacArthur Grant, because it raises the profile of this exhibition, but it also reminds people that art really matters, and it's worth taking the time to come to the Cantor, which is always free, and spending some time with this work.
Question from go ahead, Carrie Mingus.
I think is that, you know, often, you know, as we, you know, we when we started talking at the beginning of the interview, I think it's really true that, you know, that there are these very interesting shifts that are going on within our country, within our nation. And but artists have often been the forerunner, often been the forerunners in negotiating these spaces between institution and larger communities, larger constituents. And I see myself very much in that way. And I think also one of the important things that museums and institutions are doing, and one of the things that I'm most interested in doing also with the work that we have here in this retrospective, is in creating a space of habitation, creating a space that allows you to come in to begin to consider the possibilities of activating and change that is actually positioned there in the museum itself, that the museum can be a space of habitation, that it can be a space, a contemplative space, I think is absolutely essential. And that artists make that possible is true and real and important.
It's it reminds me that the director of the Cantor Center likes to tell the story that when Jane Stanford, when the university was founded, that Jane Stanford wanted to have the policy be that tuition to Stanford University would be free, but there'd be an admission charge for the museum. It's worked out the other way around, to the chagrin of most parents, but. But in a sense, that idea that the museum at Stanford is free, it sort of speaks to what you're saying in a way that it's like the museum can be the front door to the university experience, that it's a place where you can begin to take in all of the connections between art and life and politics and change.
Well, absolutely. And what's great for the fact that this exhibition is at Stanford is that Carrie's work is so complex and multi-layered, and Stanford is a center for interdisciplinary thought. And so we've been receiving requests from departments all over the university for tours, for access, not just art history and art studio, but literature, American studies, African American studies, gender studies. Everyone wants to really engage with this work, and that's absolutely inspiring.
Carrie Mae Williams, you were going to add?
Oh, I mean, you know, when you set out to make a work, I never on the one hand, you never know who you're going to reach, and you never know who you're going to touch. All you know is that you have to make the work, that you're compelled to make a work that looks at or that doesn't look at any one thing necessarily, but is multidimensional in its possibility, you know. And so it is gratifying. It is gratifying that so many parts of, for instance, in this case, the Stanford community can find itself and locate itself within the work. And I think that there's something that Elizabeth mentioned earlier that of course is a great concern of the work, and that is, what is the breadth of our humanness, and how are we limited? And how do we limit ourselves? How do we participate in our own victimization? How do we participate in our own woes? That is a question that is really sort of at the center of some of the work, as well as this sort of larger question of what is love. And I often think that I'm making a work around not necessarily race, but around unrequited love, that I'm making work around questions of history and class and family structure, monogamy as opposed to polygamy, that I'm really trying to ask myself as an artist, as a person, a number of different complex questions that in one way or another show up in the work. And so it is gratifying that so many people can locate themselves and locate their own questions in the work. Because I don't necessarily think that I provide any answers. I don't have any answers at this point anymore. But I certainly pose, I think, questions that might lead to a certain kind of resolve.
Why is it... I'm interested in the phrase that you use that about unrequited love. Is it, if we go back to what we were talking about before, the series of depictions of African Americans in history, is it unrequited love because we haven't fully understood what those images represented? Is it unrequited love because that history has been too invisible to us, and we to become requited, we need to come to terms with that? Tell me more about what you mean by that phrase.
I think that it is complex. I think that we are not seen. I think that African Americans, for the most part, even as we change, even as things are improving, shifting. I think, as Amiri Baraka used to say, we are dealing with the changing same. So that even though we, of course, we are not dealing with the same kinds of issues that we were dealing with in the 1950s and 1960s, and yet. There's the situation for African Americans in the country remains dire and bleak. And the questions of race, even with a black man in the office, you know, with the highest office in the land, in the White House, you know, where he's having a very difficult time doing his job because of race, I believe, still plagues us to a significant degree, and that we remain invisible, and that we are not necessarily yet embraced for the complex complex humanity that we actually represent. We are still seen, for the most part, as a problem. And until that changes, then we will always be dealing with this question of being misunderstood and not necessarily valued by the larger society. I saw a woman one day. I have to tell you this story. I must tell you this story because it sort of really points to, for instance, this work called Slow Fade to Black that you mentioned earlier in the program. I was sitting in the East Village sometime over the summer, and I saw this woman, a black woman, beautiful, emerge from a car. She was absolutely, to my mind, absolutely stunning. She looked like she'd walked out of the 1950s. She had a perfect French roll and this beautiful portrait dress, and in a lovely a coral color, beautiful caramel skin woman, and I thought she was just like a breath of air. And I looked around. We were in an outdoor restaurant. And I looked around to see if there was anybody else that was paying attention to this jewel. And I appeared to be the only one. And she was simply invisible. And I have felt this level of invisibility myself often and recently. So I think that these are real experiences that need to be really examined and looked at. And so, when I started thinking about this idea of unrequited love, I was actually spending a lot of time with Fellini, looking at a lot of Fellini movies and some of the great Italian cinema, and realizing that, you know, very rare instances where there are places for a woman who looked like me. If I looked at American cinema, there were very few places for a woman who looked like me. And so even though I was absolutely mad about Fellini and his movies and his vision and the way in which he produced what he made for us, I realized that he had no place for me in his heart. And so that's why I sort of got down to this place of unrequited love, that I was unseen and invisible in the eyes of this great director and filmmaker.
And you are appear in many of your own photographs as this kind of witness and guide. And is that part of why, of becoming visible, of being a kind of stand-in, of saying, notice me as I get out of the car in this coral dress. Pay attention.
I think so. I think probably in the deepest way. Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's very important for this black body to stand in for more than simply itself. And so that is driving force behind the work, that the body stands in for more than simply itself, that it stands in for a broad breadth of humanity, and that it's absolutely key that it's a black body that is standing in for that. Mm. And so in Kitchen Table, for instance, it's not necessarily a piece about an African-American woman. I think, you know, at all. And I think that's one of the reasons that so many women and men from around the country and internationally have responded so deeply to the work. And to that extent, I feel like, yes, there are some breakthroughs that are being made that are absolutely important. So this black figure, has been very important to me. I also use her, for instance, I call her my muse, even though it is me. You know, I've been running around with a raggedy camera and a tripod for years on my own. So I'm always by myself. Very rarely is there anybody working with me or helping me when I'm out photographing. But I started using this figure also in Roaming and Cuba in the Louisiana series, where her back is always turned from the audience, always turned away from the audience, and leading you into other kinds of scenes, other kinds of associations, standing before great architecture, before museums in the museum series, in Piazza di Popolo in Rome, in the Roaming series, etc. So her figure, the way in which she's used, and she's a dynamic figure, is both as a guide and as a muse and a guide, not only for me, the artist, but for the audience as well. But it was also another way, I believe, of breaking through that way in which the black subject is often so quickly read and dismissed, in the way that, you know, somebody like Malcolm Gladwell talks about it in Outliers, right? The assumptions, the quick assumptions that are made about a person through race, through gender, is slightly displaced when the back is to the audience. So the audience has something else to do, something else to think about, but not necessarily race first and foremost.
So if you had your camera with you at the moment that woman emerged from the car. What might you have taken? What might you have added to that to construct visibility?
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you asked me this question because, you know, in this studio, I'm looking at all of the equipment that's around me. And one of the things that a new project that I'm actually working on right now is about a woman who was born in the 60s, who is also turning 60. And so I'm starting to really, and I think about this woman often. Sometimes she makes me cry, but she always excites me because of the way that I'm interested in working right now. And so I'm building actually a whole narrative, a whole story in part around seeing this woman. It's going to be the basis for a new work that I'm producing right now. And the character who is delivering the story is somebody like myself who works in radio and in TV. So I'm photographing all kinds of studios. I'm photographing the mics, the mic phones, the chairs, the headsets, you know, all of that stuff that goes on in the construction of space, in the construction of TV and radio, are things that I'm very anxious to look at and to photograph us as I start to think about building my own set, my own environment for the creation and the making of this new work of making the visible, or rather the invisible, visible.
Let me ask you a question from one of our listeners who tweets in: when did Carrie Mae Weems stop being a documentary photographer and become an artist? Or does she distinguish between the two?
Oh, I think that documentary photographers are often artists. I simply thought at a certain moment that I really wasn't interested in moving around the world in that way that traditional documentary photographers work, that I wasn't interested in going around the world and capturing the image and bringing it back home in that sort of way that we've thought of documentary for a very long time. And that's one of the reasons that I really became more interested in the conceptual terrain, that as long as the photograph got at the truth, it did not really matter to me so much when it was made or where it was made or how it was made. The most important thing was that it was made, and that it was made in my own living room, my own studio, my own backyard was just as important as flying to Mozambique in order to make photographs on the ground. So, but I don't necessarily have this hard and fast rule that I'm an artist and not a documentary photographer. Rather, I'm an artist who constructs her pictures, who's not working as a documentary photographer.
Just have a few moments left, but I'm interested in asking you about your return to the Bay Area, because you lived and studied here, and what you think the role and importance of art might be in this particular location, in a city like San Francisco, which is losing much of its black population, the city of Oakland that has so many struggles. And I'm just interested in how you think art plays a role, I guess, in recreating or re-knitting a community together that that needs that.
You know, David, that's a really fascinating question, and I don't think that I can really, in the deepest way, answer that question because I don't live here anymore, and I don't know exactly what's going on in the Bay Area in the deepest way. There are, of course, important institutions, from the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art to the De Young. You know, there are important institutions that are here. I think now what San Francisco and the Bay Area is going to have to deal with is what is this new intersection between technology and culture that needs to be mined in the deepest possible way. And what's coming into San Francisco, and it has been coming into the Bay Area for, you know, the last 10, 15 years, is this incredible innovation. And yet it seems to me that that the tools are not yet in the most progressive hands. That we can say that technology is progressive, but it doesn't necessarily, that it suggests progress, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's progressive. And so one of the things that I'm sort of looking at, the question that I've had for a while, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to return a bit to have this kind of discussion at Stanford and also in San Francisco, how do we use this extraordinary technology of and social media to advance the cause of culture in this new millennium?
And if
how
I
do
might
we
get...
use it to advance the cause of women? How do we use it to advance the cause of minorities and minorities that are being pushed out of San Francisco, for instance, which is kind of a shame. The face of the city is changing. But how do we use these new technologies to advance and to reposition a culture and our relationships around race? That hasn't yet been figured out. And I challenge social media and technology masterminds and innovators to start thinking along those lines.
And of course, Elizabeth Mitchell, that's very much what you hope the role of the Cantor can continue to play in furthering that goal.
Yep, that's definitely what Stanford's all about.
We must close our program. Carrie Mae Weems, thank you so much. I hope you go out and buy a beautiful coral dress.
Thank you, David, so much for inviting me to be here.
Pleasure to have you on our program. And a reminder that we invite you all to join the premiere of KQED Newsroom tonight on KQED 9 at 8 o'clock. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.